different but similar. So this is a work I've done recently with my graduate student, Yixin Guo, at Pittsburgh. And, hello. Alright, sorry. Okay, so we're motivated by seeing how persistent states can be generated in a neural network. Right, so self-sustained states. States that are bistable with a low firing error off. And, you know, of course, the dream is it's an analog to working memory. So what I wanted to talk about today was the actual existence and the shape of these things and when do they exist and when they don't exist. So we're partway through an analysis of this, and I'll show you what we've been doing. So I'll start with looking at Wilson-Cowan equations, right? So if you take, you can take a spiking network and coarse grain, average, mean field, limit. You can get a rate equation. So I interpret U as the amount of neuronal input, synaptic input to a given neuron. W is the coupling weight, and F of U is the activity, so the gain. So the input goes through some activity, gets some firing rate, and it couples to all the other nodes. So this is standard. And then it's the choice of the gain function, which is important. This is a square root, so that I show a gain function for, say, a typical type 1 neuron near the threshold of firing and with no adaptation. Would look somewhat like this.
Why isn't it sigmoid? Why isn't it exponential now at the bottom here?
There's no noise in this, so it's a threshold. And then if there was a little bit of noise, you'd have a little... You can derive Wilson-Cowan many ways. Mm-hmm. You can average over populations, and that can that then you don't need any noise. Mm-hmm. Then you can stick in whatever gain function you like. So I guess if I said explicitly Wilson-Cowan, it would have a like smooth thing. But if it's Wilson-Cowan family, you can put in whatever.
Is it going to be important?
It won't be that important. Okay. It won't be that important.
So, but still, it's assumed that all neurons in the population have the same threshold.
I assume all neurons have the same threshold. And that's also, that would smooth things out if you were to average. So all these questions are legitimate, and I'm not going to talk about it in this talk, but I have looked at smooth gain functions. And so what we're really interested in is the solution of this system, right? This integral equation. U is equal to convolution over f of u. Here's an example of an f. We can try many f's. So for classes of f's, classes of w's, what sort of solutions do you get out of these? That's what I'm interested in. And the reason why I was faced with this is because when we were looking at integrating fire neurons, we were looking at these bumps, we kind of realized that we didn't really know what parameters to choose to get nice localized pulses. It just so happened we would guess and it would work, and we didn't have a systematic way of doing it. My postdoc Carlo Lang is a magician with these. He can make anything. He can find a small parameter regime as there exists and make it work. So I thought that there's got to be a systematic way because Carlo will leave soon and I'll have to find them myself. And so I set my other graduate student on figuring out a systematic way to find them. So we all know that if you have a constant solution, then it's just an intersection of the diagonal with the gain function, and these are the locations of the solutions. So I think seeing this was what motivated the self-persistent, the whole persistent activity game, was knowing this, and this is basically Curie-Weiss law from magnetism, right? So it's this bistability of up and down, and I think that, so the game we play is that this is off and this is on, and you can kick back and forth, and they're both stable. And this fixed point is an unstable fixed point.
Yeah. Is W Mexican hit? So you actually have effective inhibition in this, or at this point it doesn't matter. But
at this point it doesn't matter. Eventually W will be Mexican hat, and then we are also looking at two populations of excitatory and inhibitory to show that you get an effective Mexican hat on the E cells, so that. But what I'm going to talk about is just purely one layer of Mexican hat. So the Mexican hat, so here's a classic Mexican hat. This is the difference of two Gaussians. This one I call the witch's hat, which is the difference of two exponentials. Right? So it looks kind of like a witch's hat. It's actually a name that Quabana Balahan at Penn came up with on the spur of the moment when I was showed him this thing. He said, that's not a Mexican hat, that's a witch's hat. So I adapted that terminology. Oh my God, oops. Missed a thing. So, I'm sure. Okay. So this looking at these localized pulses started, I think, with Amari in 77. And it's a really good paper. If you've never read it, it's a classic that everyone should read because he really covered practically all the bases, and I'm just sort of filling in just minor little details of what he did. But he said, suppose I have a Heaviside gain function, okay? And that's a great function to choose because then my existence condition, the Heaviside is 1 when U is above threshold, and 0 elsewhere, so I just assume that it's only above threshold between minus xt and t, then I just have to integrate over this region. And now I have the condition for a pulse is that at the edge, at x equals xt, u is equal to the threshold, so now I just have a condition for ut and w. And for example, if I use the witch's hat gain function, I plug that in, I do the integral, then here's the existence condition. If I can find solutions for xt, then I found pulses, right? So that was Amari's brilliant insight. So it so happens that the existence condition can take many forms, but for a Mexican hat with a lot of inhibition at outer regions, then it can look like this. And then here's the threshold. So you always get a small one and a big one, right? You get two, which is the same intuition you would have gotten from just the if you have a convex down gain function for constant solutions, you always have those two, right? The unstable. What's that?
What are you plotting?
What am I plotting?
What is the y-axis?
Okay, so let me go back.
So when you say pulse, you really mean bounce. Pulse would be traveling, right?
A pulse can be stationary.
So a stationary pulse, which we
I hate the term bump, so I've been calling it pulse. Bump is a pulse.
But you're talking about stationary pulse.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes,
velocity of light is 0.
Bump was a term I actually introduced because Bill Skaggs used it.
So what's wrong with it?
I just think it's so vulgar sounding.
Oh.
Okay, so what am I plotting? I'm plotting this function. This thing is a function of x. Okay? When this thing is equal to u of t, I have a solution.
Xt.
Right, so this is a function of xt.
Xt is
the width of the pulse. Okay?
So
I didn't explain
Carson, that. So the condition for the existence of a pulse is just your integral equation. Right?
This is the condition for the existence of a pulse. U of t is equal to the integral over the gain function.
And that?
Between x minus xt and xt.
And you get that because that's your integral equation, right?
That's my integral equation. And the condition simply is at the boundary, u is equal to ut. That's the condition for a pulse.
Okay.
U is equal to ut at xt. So now if I do the integral, I get this thing. And I should have explained it better. So now if I plot the right-hand side, okay, this is that existence condition, okay? It's that function of xt. This is xt. And then this is ut. So when this existence condition is equal to ut, you have a pulse.
So this is the infinite one dimension?
This is infinite one dimension. Right.
And the one on the left hand side is stable.
You could have several. I'll talk about several.
Sarah? So this is one.
This is one.
One.
There's two different ones. There's two possible solutions. So over here, I've drawn the two possible solutions. Okay, so here's the big one is in black, and the little one in this case, because it's so close to threshold, right? It's just barely. It's just a teeny weeny one. It's just that thing.
So the interactions go eventually to zero in the Mexican hat, right?
It's a Mexican hat, but it's exponentially decaying, so it's never absolutely zero.
You don't have another one because they still feel the.
It always feels the influence forever, and I'll talk about multiple bump solutions, but there's always an interaction. So I haven't chosen the compact support. Obviously, if you add it on compact support, you can just put them. So in that sense, it's kind of a mathematical exercise, but I just wanted to investigate on the real line, because your stuff was always on the periodic thing, and I wanted to know what was it like on the real line. But, and you have some stuff on the real line. So that was Amari in 77, and this was the intuition, and I was interested in knowing what would happen, why is it so slow, if you didn't have a saturating gain function, okay? So I put a little lid on there and I flip it up with alpha, and the simple question was, does that change anything?
Amari was this case which you just considered.
So Amari was alpha equals...
step function.
Exactly. Amari was an infinite line with a step function. I'm looking at infinite line with a jump linear.
And so, Carson, if you plot xt as a function of ut, if ut gets too big, these two solutions coalesce and disappear.
Exactly. So if you choose, there's a saddle node bifurcation where the two annihilate each other and then they disappear.
At ut equals some special number?
At some ut or some at, so I should...
Some area condition?
Some, it's actually, for the Amari case, it's just an area condition. For this, what I'm going to show you, it's an ugly
kind of condition. The question, it looks like for all these stabilities, the key to have the gain function come up and then saturate. Gain function for threshold linear, now does it work?
Threshold linear, you would only get one solution, and it would be unstable for the sublinear, for the super sub-threshold case. For the super-threshold case, it's not a problem. And the reason why, you can see, is that if it's piecewise linear, then the slope has to be bigger than one when it intersects the line, and that kind of is the intuition. If the input is super threshold, then if it's just monotonic, you only have one bump. But we really never looked at that regime.
So all you say is just about.
I'm always talking about the sub-threshold regime. But the formalism I'm going to describe to you could be applied to either regime. So the question becomes, can we show the existence of pulse solutions of this form? So between minus xt and xt, you're above threshold. So that's the bump. And then below, you are some form, right? We just sketch something. It doesn't have to be this. All it has to be is below threshold. Has to go to zero at infinity. We insist on that. And it's symmetric. Okay, so this is what we're looking for. We're asking, can we find solutions of this form? And then later I'll talk about solutions of, say, double bump. So the strategy is to transform this integral equation to an ODE. Okay, so and there are some good reasons for it. So a bump in an ODE, so I'll go through and I'll tell you how you do the transformation, then I'll discuss why we would want to transform it to an ODE. So this is a convolution between W and some nonlinear function of U, so I can take the Fourier transform, and that deconvolves it, right? It doesn't solve it, because even if you were to solve for U and try to do the inverse Fourier transform, it would still be a mess. So it doesn't solve it. Except in the Amari case where it does. The Amari case is a magical case that just turns out really easy to solve. So for the witch's hat, so let me remind you that I'm going to set big B and little b equal to 1. So the two parameters I'll talk about is big A, which is the amount of excitation relative to inhibition, and little a, which is the width of the excitation footprint relative to the width of the inhibition footprint. Okay, these will be two parameters, big A, little a, and I'll also talk about alpha. And I'll fix ut for most of my discussion. Now, so I took Fourier transform, and now the Fourier transform of this gain function, the nice thing about the witch's hat is that the Fourier transform of the witch's hat is a rational function, right? So when I put that back into the previous expression, I had Fourier transform of u is equal to Fourier transform of w times Fourier transform of little f of u. I can rearrange and I get... So you can see where I'm going. I'm going to try to convert this back to an ODE. Right? So I have a polynomial in the Fourier transform variable S multiplied by f of u. So up to here, everything's great. I can Fourier transform back. it would be really easy. The only thing that makes it life difficult is this s squared multiplied by f, big F. Okay, so when I have to inverse Fourier transform this thing, that's where all the interesting stuff comes in.
Could
otherwise,
you derive ODE without going through Fourier?
I could have derived it otherwise, but this is just this is one way to do it. So this term, when I take the inverse Fourier transform, I have to get the s squared in there, right? And so you can do it, integrate by parts several times. And what you're going to end up with is a couple of boundary terms. Okay, you're going to get these boundary-dependent terms. So now when I plug everything back and take the inverse transform to get an ODE, some of my math colleagues will complain that it should be called an ODE because it's an ODE with these jump conditions at the boundaries. Right? And there's two jumps. There's a delta prime jump. That's because of the step function jump. So that's the derivative of the delta function jump. And then there's the delta jump, which is due to the piecewise linear part. So if I were to look at purely piecewise linear with no jump, I would have this term. And if I were to look at the Heaviside case, I would have just that term. And then there's these contributions also from the curvature of F and the slope of F is also important, the gain function. Now, if I were to choose a smooth gain function, so instead of using the one with the piecewise jumps, I can still use this form, then these guys are just zero, right? But then I still have to take into account the... So then these terms here would just be picked up by the curvature, which picks up a delta prime, and the slope picks up a delta. And in fact, so one of the things we do is we do look at smooth gain functions, and we look at this ODE, nonlinear ODE system, and then we look at the piecewise linear, we look at that system.
So if piecewise linear, you have a sum of terms, right? And for every piece you get done.
Right, so the piecewise linear part is between... depending on where you are, so if U is greater than U threshold, then I use, you know, these terms are in there. When U is less than, then I can ignore everything. I just get this top part. Okay, so so just to reiterate, the solutions must satisfy the boundary conditions. So what I mean is U is greater than the threshold in the interior between minus XT and XT. I'm going to choose that it's symmetric, so the first derivative and third derivative
XT
are zero.
XT
has to be found self-consistently. It's not known at this point.
That's why it's not ODE.
Technically it's not an ODE. It's a, I don't know what to call it though.
If it were closer, it would still be.
Yeah. Well, so I don't know what to call it. It's some sort of differential equation. Maybe it's not ordinary.
It's an eigenvalue, nonlinear eigenvalue.
It's a nonlinear eigenvalue problem.
No, but
arbitrary thing.
Yeah. Well, anyway, whatever it's called, we know what the problem is, right?
Well, I didn't say exactly what the problem is. So you have to solve it for all xt. And then find the one which satisfies some condition. That's what you do.
I'm trying to look to see whether or not I can find a solution where there's a u greater than ut in this intermediate region. I don't know where that intermediate region is, and that u has to go to zero. U and all its derivatives go to zero at infinity, and they match. And they match across the boundary. And then they match across the boundary.
So you say whether there exists such an xt.
Does there exist such an xt that satisfies all these conditions? Okay, is that clear?
So, what if you draw the symmetric conditions? Are there any solutions that are not symmetric?
That's a good question. Now, I don't know, and it would be hard to look for them. I mean, you just have more conditions that you would have to look for. And numerically, people have looked for them, and nobody's really ever found them. That doesn't mean they don't exist. But
you can look for pure odd ones, demand U. And
you can look for periodic ones, that's
you
clear.
Look for pure odd ones.
Oh, pure odd ones.
U of 0 equals U delta times 0 equals 0.
Yeah, I guess you could look for pure odd ones. We never did. We never did.
Did you ever do any simulations when it wasn't symmetric? When you start breaking the symmetry, you start moving slowly.
You mean break the symmetry of the coupling? Yeah. If you break the symmetry of the coupling, yeah, you can get movement and stuff. So I think his question was whether you can have symmetric coupling and still break symmetry.
Right.
Have a non-symmetric solution. And that one, we don't know. That's still a question. So the matching conditions are that u is equal to the threshold at xt, right? And the first derivative matches. Now, because of the jump, you get a jump in the second derivative and the third derivative. Okay, and that depends on the value of u at xt, right? So if you have to put them all in together. Question?
Okay, we're arguing whether that's possible that we're non-centrifugal.
You can't rule it out, I don't think. You can always ask for it.
Okay, you can
ask. Well, let's just put it this way. There's no simple proof to rule it out. There might be a... There might be one. You can't use symmetry alone to rule it out. So in region 1, the solutions have this form. Okay, remember region 1 is in between minus xt and xt, and region 2 is on the right-hand side, so greater than xt, and region 3 is on the left-hand side. And region 3 and region 2 are just mirror images of each other, so you really only have to look at the region 1 and region 2. Okay, so there, because it's a linear, it's piecewise linear, region 1 is simply a combination of exponentials, and region 2 is a combination of exponentials. I've already built into the u prime equals 0 and u triple prime equals 0 conditions, so that's built into the first one. And then now we have to make this thing match this thing across the boundary with through all the three derivatives. Okay, so the eigenvalues, this eigenvalue, I mean just the eigenvalue of the ODE, is given by this omega plus or minus, and so r has this form, delta has this form. And another thing that makes this thing tedious is that as you move the parameters around, omega goes from real to complex and back. And so when you try to patch together all these things, you have to do a lot of bookkeeping to keep track of where you are. Okay? So that's the game. Now when we now we do the matching. So there's five matching conditions because u is equal to, they all match across each other through through the field and the three derivatives. And the final matching condition is that the field has to be equal to ut at the boundary, right? So that's the five different conditions. And so then you have the five unknowns because you have the four coefficients of the ODEs, and then you have the last one is the location xt, which makes it a non-ODE. So if you can find a solution to this system, then you found the bump pulse. Okay, so this looks deceptively simple, and in the Amari case it is, because in the Amari case, omega plus and omega minus are simply a and b. And if that's A and B, then you can solve this thing by hand and you get the beautiful Amari expression. Once it's not Amari, this thing is unwieldy. So if you can put this on math, so our strategy is that it's a fake linear system, right? Because in the coefficients, it's a linear system. So what we do is we solve the linear system for the coefficients, then we can plug it back into here, then we have a condition for x of t, right? That's the Amari strategy. Then you just have to find a condition for x of t. If you do that and you solve it in its native form, put it in Mathematica, you'll just get 10 to 30 pages. We lost count of Mathematica output. So that's not really viable, unfortunately. So one of the things I'm having my student do, she's a math PhD, is to actually work on proving that there's solutions. But in the meantime, what you have to do is you have to plug in guesses. Okay, so this is not that much of an advantage over just solving the integral equation, but it does give you some little things. So if you plug in big A equals 1, big B equals 0.65, I in our future stuff, we're actually going to renormalize. So in this case, I have big A is 1, little a is this, little b is this. Beta is the jump height, and alpha is the slope. Okay? So this is the parameters. Then the existence condition. So that's what we did, is we actually took the 5x5 system, we plugged in these numbers, then we solved for the coefficients C, D, E, and F, plugged it into the first equation, and that's what you get. Whenever this thing intersects the line, you get a solution. And here, on the bottom, I just like this figure. Nobody else seems to care. But the blue one is the solution in the inner region. Okay, so that's just the solution in the inner region. The black line is the solution in the outer region. And they match at ut. And I just like it because, you know, if you plot them, so this is actually just plotting the inner one from here to here and the outer one from here to here. We should have used a different color. You can see by eye, you can't see the difference, right? You can. So I think that you can't see by eye changes in second and third derivatives. It's really hard, unless you're an architect or something. So I don't know. I just, when we first did this, right? We just did it and we put it together and I made her do it and it worked out. I thought it was.
It's a kiss.
I thought it was nice. Yeah, it's a kiss. And it. You want to go to the back slide? Sure.
There is another problem here that even if you have a solution of this,
yeah,
you have to check that it's consistent in the sense that it doesn't cause zero gain.
Yes.
The solution is all the time below zero.
Yes, but that's guaranteed in some sense by the sign of E and F. Okay? So if you know what the sign of E and F are, then you can check for that ahead of time. But you're right. You do have to check. You have to check E and F. And
exactly. So we impose that sign condition as well. Well, whatever the condition that that being said, we do check. So that's drawing it up.
Analysis ways too, which is. Okay, so that's just, and that's very close to Amari, okay? So when I showed Bard, Ehrmantraut, my colleague, he was like not impressed. And he was very well, a lot of these pictures he was unimpressed with until the very end, which then he was impressed because we found a solution that he thought could never exist. So then he became impressed. Sort of.
Should this look like Amari's?
This looks exactly like Amari. What's that?
When alpha goes to zero, this should look like Amari, and beta goes to one.
Exactly. When alpha is equal to zero, it's exactly Amari. Oh. So this is now. So the first thing I showed you, this last picture was a really small slope, right, 0.1, yeah. And everything looks very much like Amari. This looks like Amari. This solution looks very much like Amari. So now we increase the slope a little bit. Okay. So now the inner solution has oscillations because we transition to a region where you have complex eigenvalues. So this is actually goes like here, goes like here, goes like that. Okay? And it'll just keep oscillating with increasing amplitude. And so we're just looking at the inner region. And then the black one is the outer region, which is these kind of singular exponential type of functions. The black does not oscillate. The black will never oscillate because in the outer region it's always A and B are the eigenvalues. So the inner ones can oscillate. And when I saw this, I started to think, aha, there's possibility for double solutions because you can get an oscillation. And so now when we patch it together, we get the big guy here, and you do the same thing with the little one. And because these parameters always happen to be chosen so that the little one is extremely close to threshold, it just looks like that.
And it's still true that always the big solution is always stable and
correct. In the rate system, the big one is always stable and the little one's unstable. We don't have a proof. We don't have a proof of that. But then we do simulations of the integral equation, and we plug this as an initial condition. It hangs around. This one never hangs around. And we're working on trying to get a more solid proof. Okay, so now when alpha is 1, so this is a pretty big slope now, then you get something pretty interesting, is that you start to lose continuity of the existence condition. These are not solutions. Okay, we plug them in; they're not. They violate David's. They go above zero, or they do all sorts of things. So, this is still the only two solutions. Unfortunately, I was all excited. I thought that there was a whole train of these solutions. Turns out they weren't. But now you really see that there's a wiggle. Right? You can really make out the wiggle in the inner solution. The outer solution always looks the same. If you patch it together, it still looks pretty much the same. So one of the things that this thing does give you is that you can find the inner solution, the little solution, easily. And if you were to solve that integral equation, it's really hard to find that little one because, A, it's unstable in the ODE, and usually the solver you use is kind of some iteration scheme that's essentially finding the stable fixed points of that ODE, right? That's because I've talked to people on how to solve these nonlinear integral equations, and every numerical analyst I talk to sort of doesn't want to deal with it. So there's really not a good scheme to find all the solutions. So that's the motivation why we went to this ODE thing, because there's all these good ODE solvers. And in the smooth case, in the ODE, what we're looking for is a homoclinic orbit. Okay, so this is really what we're looking for, because in the ODE, remember, x is now mapped to time. So what we're starting is a solution where u is 0 at x equals minus infinity, and then it goes through some loop transition, and it goes back to 0, the positive infinity, right? So if you think of 0 as a fixed point, then this thing is just a thing that made a trajectory from a fixed point, comes back an infinite amount of time. That's just a homoclinic orbit. And now, because of auto, there are all these continuation programs that can find homoclinic orbits and follow them. You can do the smooth case by following homoclinic orbits. In our case, we're doing it essentially by hand by solving it in the two regimes. So that's what I'll do next, is then the power, the real reason why we did this is now we can follow these solutions, right, by using auto. And the way we do it, what we're actually following here is that 5x5 system. So I'm following an algebraic system. Because we solved that, remember, we solved the ODEs by hand. We said, here's the matching conditions. What are the solutions to those matching conditions? I can stick it into auto and follow them by hand.
So you're doing the transcendental equations with auto?
Yeah. The way we cheat is we convert it into a little ODE where the fixed point is the solution, and then we follow it using auto. Because that's what auto's doing, right? It's just finding the fixed point, and then you change the parameter a little bit. Oh, okay. Auto is a continuation tool. What it is it takes any ODE or PDE system, and if you find a fixed point, you want to know how does the bifurcations happen as you change a parameter. So it can find a fixed point, find the stability of the fixed point, then it moves the parameter just a little bit, finds a new fixed point, finds the stability, moves it a little bit. So it's just doing by hand. It's doing for you what you would have done by hand. And it actually, the amazing thing about auto is it follows it through the bifurcations. When it hits a branch, it'll follow the two branches.
So it only finds the fixed points.
You can get to the fine limit cycles or homoclinics also. So these long orbits. If you have any solution, you can follow it. If there's any solution, you can specify, and auto knows that the solution exists. It'll then change the parameters and follow that solution. And it'll go through all the bifurcations and follow those branches. So what we did here is, because we have this 5x5 system, right? It's a transcendental system.
Algebraic.
Exactly, for the matching conditions. Oops, a little too far. So what I did is what we wanted to do is say, find the solutions of this system.
This is not ODE. I thought auto you do it for ODE.
Well, it is true you do for ODE, but all you do is you just do the trick of you write an ODE where this is the fixed point of the ODE, and then you ignore the stability of it, right? So I just simply have C dot is equal to minus C plus this equation, and then D dot is equal to, and then I plug that into auto. I mean, I could have just written my own false solver for this, but since auto already exists and he had it only for ODEs, that's what we did. Okay, so we just followed the solutions of this system. Is that clear? That's what I mean by auto.
Could you just put the integral equations on, or no?
You can't do integral equations in auto. And part of the reason is because there's so many solutions, I think. Part of it's the formalism's not set up, but even if it were, I don't think that we know enough about the properties of integral equations to really follow. Okay, so this is the reason why we did all of this, is so that I could change parameters and see where the solutions go. So in this case, what we're doing is we're changing the slope, alpha. Okay, so the right-hand side is just a blow-up of the left-hand side. The right-hand side is alpha 0, that's the heavy side case. There's two solutions you can follow, and then when we increase the slope, the big solution eventually dies. The little solution persists forever. And now the reason why there's all these different colors is that this is where the eigenvalue structure changed, right, from real to complex to so forth. And when it changes...
What is the so far?
The which?
What is the beyond complex?
Oh, I mean real to complex back to real to... to in pure imaginary too. I didn't mean that there was, you know, octanon. Oh, yeah. I didn't mean that there are other number fields that it went to. I just meant that it would make transitions back and forth. But each time you, because Otto doesn't deal with complex systems, you have to write it out, right? So we have the form for when it's purely real, purely imaginary, complex, and then you patch them all together. So really, Otto went from this to the red dot, and we had to use the other green system, and we did the green system to here, then we did another red system, and then a blue system. And I think the fact that they lined up gave us confidence that we at least did the algebra correctly for all the five different systems. So you see that at alpha equals zero, there's always two solutions. This one definitely dies. Okay, what happens here is that it blows up. The amplitude blows up. So there's a finite slope where you lose that solution. The little one's always there. Now, if you want to see the saddle node, right, you think that eventually the two will coalesce, you have to go to negative alpha. So you have to have a gain function that's like this, right? So it's kind of the more input you get, the slower you fire. So if you do, and you have to go pretty far, right? You have the minus 15. So this is just the parameters we chose. You will never really see the coalescing.
Never see.
But there is the saddle node. So we just wanted to make sure that there was a saddle node. So in this case, if you make alpha smaller, you will eventually get the saddle node. So one of the reasons why we started this was that we wanted to know how you could get low firing rates. In fact, Haim asked this question of me in October. He said, you know, how do you find these things? And so I've actually been pushing my student to come up with criteria for all these pictures, and she's working on it. And the problem is we don't really still have a nice condition saying, you know, big A is this, this is this, we get one. But what we can say is to get low firing rates, you're going to have to be near the saddle node. So
why did you go to big alphas with no slow firing rate?
So right now I'm not showing you the right figure. I'm just showing you the width.
The right figure, if you go to big alpha.
If you go to big alpha, you get higher firing rates. But I'm not showing you firing rates. I'm just showing you width.
I think the slower solution is the smaller solution you have low firing rates.
I should show you height. Okay. So here's the height. The height is the firing rate. Because it goes through the gain function, you get the hiring rate. So height is proportional to hiring rate. Firing.
Yeah, but this lower solution is slow.
Oh, the lower solution is unstable.
Even if it's the only one that should, it's always unstable.
It's always unstable. Even when it's the only one, it's unstable. So over here, you just have nothing. You just blow up to infinity. Okay? So here's the problem. This is the high firing rate problem. The problem is that once you have it, you just have to increase a little bit of slope. You get a huge increase in height, and then that goes through the gain function. You get a huge. So this is why it's so hard to find low firing rates, is that you got to sit, you know, somewhere close to the saddle node.
So maybe I missed what is alpha negative?
What's that?
What is negative alpha?
Negative alpha is just the gain function looks like that. And it's just a mathematical curiosity. It's not meant to be physical. We just wanted to continue with this to see this, the connection. So the question is, so what we wanted to understand was how could you get these things to choose parameter regimes with low firing rates? And what we're finding is that, which is what the intuition had led you to believe, is that it really restricts you because of this exponential blow up. So this is really a blow up. There's a finite time blow up here. We don't have a proof for it, but we're pretty sure that there's a blow up right there.
It's not so unreasonable that that the firing rate could go down as the input goes way up in some spiking
models. Right, but then you're in the saturated regime. So alpha equals zero is saturation, right? And the thing that we wanted was to get low firing rates, not near saturation. That was Haim's. You missed Haim's talk yesterday, but that was one of his points. And and the problem is, well, for this set of parameters, you certainly, unless this is already low to start with, right? And we don't have, but you can imagine that you just have a little bit of too much gain on your neuron, you're going to hard to find low firing rates. So in this case, we chose, this is just an example where alpha is really, really small, right? This is almost zero, so 0.04. And the only reason why we chose this is so you can get nice pictures on one like this. But all we want to show you is that if you change the amount of excitation, if you have too much excitation, then you just start to get this increase in the height and the width. And there's the saddle node right there. So probably you want to sit near the saddle node. So you want to sit near the edge of the saddle. They're just two different pictures. This is the height picture, and this is just the width.
Both of them correspond to stable. The upper branch is the stable.
Upper branch is a stable branch. Lower branch is unstable. And then they connect through the saddle node.
I thought that the ring model, if you increase the excitation, the bump becomes narrower.
If you increase the excitation, in this one it gets bigger.
So what's the difference?
You have also to... If you
fix everything, you just
put it. No, because that's not acceptation. That's the coefficient of the cosine.
Right,
that's the modulation. It's not doing acceptation.
So what does it, but...
Here it's doing acceptation.
I understand, but somehow you should...
You can change A and...
If you make A bigger, it's going to... It's the extent is going to be... You have to make A bigger, then make little a bigger as well. Right? So they're not exactly the same. And so the next one I show how you, so now I change little a, okay, so now I make the excitation narrower, and then you go towards here. So, if you want to fire at a low firing rate, you kind of want to be in a balanced regime. You want excitation to be weak compared to inhibition. I think that was the take-home story, and we're still working on that. Now,
this was only the alpha positive, right?
These pictures are alpha positive, yeah. And you can also look at them for...
The alpha negative is a kind of infective model for nonlinear vision.
Yeah, so we could look at alpha negative too. So here's where the real value of the ODE thing, and that is finding these little cute things, okay? So this dimple, the dimple bump, I mean, that one would be really hard to find. To find initial conditions to get you that in the integral equation would be tough to find. So we were able to find that. And then the real heroic thing was to find this one. So what you have to do for this is now there's x1 and x2, so now you have 10 equations and 10 unknowns. And I beat my grad student to solve that. She's able to do that.
So this is in the regime where you don't have two separate bumps?
This is actually in the interaction regime. This distance is they're interacting. So it's two bumps, and they're both within.
Not the infinities, but
they're very close together.
They're not separate. They cannot be more separate than this, in this molecule.
That we don't know. We haven't investigated the full. All we're saying is that what we did is we plugged in these things, and she, you know, then it becomes looking for an even smaller needle in a haystack, and she was able to find this. And now, so Bard and Bill Troy, other mathematicians, had a theorem that said in the Amari case, it's impossible to have two bumps. Okay, so they have this theorem, and I said, well, maybe with the flip the lid up, you can get two bumps. I had my student look for it, and she found two bumps. Then they revised their theorem, so now they have a new theorem that says you can't have two bumps.
You could find bumps which are far apart. Why you say you don't know where they
are? No, but they're exponential.
This is actually exponential, so there is a theorem that says you can't have bumps far apart.
But these closed bumps you can't have.
Yeah.
In
this case. No, I'm talking about your case.
In our case, you can have closed bumps.
But can you have bumps which are far apart?
We don't know. We never really... We didn't find them yet, but doesn't mean they don't exist. Because
the legs.
What's that?
So for these parameters, you don't have far apart.
So for these parameters, this is it. This is all you got for these parameters.
There are other parameters that have bumps which are far.
Exactly, and the problem is because we don't have a nice analytical form, we have to actually go through and solve each one by hand. But that's what we're working on.
So Carson, if you start with two bumps far apart,
yeah,
they must annihilate in time. Time must be exponentially long compared to...
So if you actually put in initial conditions.
Yeah.
We never looked at the dynamics of interaction. They probably will hang around for a long time. I don't know if do they collide or do they drift apart? I don't know.
But you can also truncate the interactions.
Right.
If you truncate the interaction, then it's trivial, right? Because it's just separate domains. So in that sense, that's why the far apart bump is kind of an elementary exercise, because it doesn't go to infinity. But the close bump is interesting, because this is well within the interaction regime, right? The thing is decaying like this. Okay, so this is well within their Mexican hats. And the fact that you can get this double bump is pretty interesting. Now the question is it stable? Okay, so here's another controversy. So we found this thing in our ODE system, then we plugged this initial condition into our integral equation solver, and bang, it was there. So it's stable as far as our integral solver is. Then Bill Troy comes along and says, we have a theorem that says all double bumps are unstable. And yet he can find them in his integral solver too. So then the question is the discretization of the solver enough to stabilize these things, or is what is it? We don't know. In this system, on the real line, continuum system. What's that?
With the linear, in this model?
With the Heaviside, with the Amari step function.
But it's not Amari, is it?
So, I should say that. Then we also found the double bump with the Amari.
Oh, I see. So you're saying the double bump, the other.
Right, so I should back up. So, let me back up. We were working on the single bump case. We found this dimple bump. And I said, we got a dimple bump. I mean, I could make bigger dimple bumps. Eventually, a really big dimple bump is a double bump, right? Now, I should also say the transition between this and this is extremely hard to find. The only way we could do it was to go through the super threshold regime. We could not find a path from dimple to double through the sub-threshold regime by any change of parameters we tried.
So it's a separate solution branch?
The thing is that they're connected through by changing the gain function from sub-threshold to super threshold. So to go smoothly from here to here, you have to raise inputs above threshold, dimpleize it, and then take them away.
I thought we were just changing parameters in the algebraic system.
We are.
So what are you talking about the super threshold and sub threshold?
You mean the extended input?
Because remember that the threshold, here's our gain function, here's the threshold. Okay? So that's in comparison to some baseline input, which is zero. In order to go, the only way we could find to go from here to here in a continuous path was to use UT as a parameter. And what you do is you bring UT here. But you have to simultaneously vary other parameters, right? So you're going in this hyperplane, and you can find a path in hyperplane if you vary all the parameters together, but UT has to be one of them.
But to go from the single bump to the double bump, not from the dimple, but from the...
To go from the single through the dimple to the double, the only way we could get there in one smooth change of parameters is to go through the super threshold regime. And we have a quasi...
But you didn't
explanation
from the simple bump to the double bump without going through the dimple.
Right. We didn't. So we don't really.
Well,
right.
You can't.
It's smooth. I mean, how can you?
We don't know what the other path could be.
How can you deform the single bump to double bump?
Without going through the dimple, I don't know how.
No, but without. I mean, independent of parameters. I mean, you have to deform the shapes.
Yeah. So the way I was thinking is you make the single bump fatter and fatter, right? So we know how to make it fatter and fatter. Eventually it becomes a dimple. And if you make a really fat one, then it becomes a double. And the only way to do it smoothly is to go through this. That's just a mathematical point. But okay, so now I should go on. So Bard had this theorem. Because Bard and Boris Goodkin were looking for double bumps in their integral system before I got there. And they could never find it. And then Bard, in the Amari system.
They couldn't find, so they proved it didn't exist.
And then using some Mexican hat,
that's
okay? And then they had a proof that said that it couldn't exist.
Uh-huh.
But the proof said it couldn't exist for interaction distances greater than some value. Uh-huh. Okay? That was the proof. The condition said, beyond this, you can't get a thing. Then we were looking around, and because I saw the dimple bump, I said, well, maybe, you know, if you have non-saturating, you can get a double bump.
What is the compared to which scale?
Compared to the inner, say the little a, the decay of the excitation, and then the rest is inhibition.
So the inhibition has to be sufficiently broader than excitation.
Oh yeah.
For
anything, Oh, you mean for Bard's proof?
Yeah.
For his proof, he assumes yes, there's an excitation region in the middle, and then there's an inhibition region on the tail.
Yeah, but you said there was a condition about the range.
Oh, meaning the separation between this two.
The solution.
Yeah, he said that there's no solution if this thing is bigger than some condition, which is related to the Mexican hat. And they thought, well, okay, fine, you can't have far apart bumps, then there's no possible. Then they didn't. They were just thinking to themselves, well, closer together would.
So in Amari's case, did you find the solution?
We found it later. We found it in Amari's case.
Oh, so you're going to.
I'm not going to show it.
So you found it in Amari's case.
We first found it in this thing, right?
Right, but and then we found it also in Amari.
And then we just simply lowered it, and we found it in Amari's case.
So when you found it,
it did not violate the theorem. We actually found it in a different regime. Okay. The theorem was correct, okay. As far as we know.
As far as you know, there's no violation of the theorem.
There's no violation of the theorem, but the theorem just said that you couldn't have far apart guys, and you can find close together ones. And then, so now they have a new paper that says, okay, yeah. You can find them in this region. So now they have a theorem that says if you do find them, they're always unstable.
They didn't prove they exist, though.
Oh.
They did prove that.
Now they found them. They have some proof that you can find them now. Oh. I think. I have to look at it. This is the paper with Carlo Lang and Phil Troy.
Nearby bumps on unstable.
They claim this is unstable.
But you found them stable.
We found them, we put them into our integral solver, they put it into their integral solver, they stay around. I mean, they stay around for as long as the simulation goes, and so now they're trying to come up with an explanation for why the simulation says they're stable. And
Paper 3.
I happen to think it's the discretization is stabilizing.
But is
they're stable in the integral solver, which is really just solving the ODE.
But not in a proper simulation.
Yeah. They are stable in a proper simulation of the integral equation.
Or the original one, yeah.
Of the actual u dot is equal to minus u plus integral, discretized on a rectangular grid, right? We don't know if that's critical. So what we need someone to do is to write a fancier interpolating integral solver that makes it more smooth and see whether it's stable. But so as far as we know, it's stable in the poor man's simulation of the thing. So
the Lie analysis should be possible in principle, but just mind-boggling hard.
I don't know if it's mind-boggling hard. We just haven't looked at it. It's harder than the Amari case because in the Amari case, the way they do stability is they just look at the boundaries.
Double bump the Amari case.
Yeah. So they did it. They did the stability for the Amari case and found it's unstable. So the analysis says on a continuum system, the double bump that satisfies those conditions is unstable.
You could probably do like a Galois equation on the lattice, right?
So now what we have to do is do the stability on the lattice. You are correct, which we have not done.
Hard.
Well, it's actually more of a pain because then you have to like do it in this giant. You have to solve this giant eigenvalue system. You have to plug in. You have to numerically generate the solution, plug it in, and then we're really talking about the eigenvalues are covering really close to the origin. So any little bit, you have to be a professional numerical analyst to do this. Is what I'm trying to say.
Now, but, if you can do two bumps, can you do a bunch of little bumps?
So I think that you can get probably four. I think I haven't. I'm not going to set my grad student to look for that because then it's solving, 20 equations and 20 unknowns. But I have a feeling you could probably get that there's probably a hierarchy of 2 to 4 to 6 to 8 to infinity because we know the periodic solution exists, right? I mean, that we know. So I have a feeling that you could probably go to more and more. They're really hard to, they get harder and harder to find, obviously. But, so that's, so there's a lot of work for mathematicians. Yeah.
What is the mode that it becomes unstable? Very high frequency?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I should go back. So why is it easy to do the Amari stability case? The reason why it's easy is they do this kind of cheat stability in that they calculate they calculate the dynamics for the boundaries. And then they do dynamics on the boundaries, and what they show is that the boundaries start to increase. So the thing gets fatter and fatter. But what you really want to do is a real stability analysis in space-time to find all the eigenmodes, and nobody's done that. Right, so what they do is they write down these effective equations for them. And then I think they show it.
It
goes to the stationary solution.
It can
be either one. There's also this solution.
Cool.
is homogeneous.
Yeah, it's all homogeneous. Homogeneous and on is a solution. Homogeneous and on.
Homogeneous and on.
Yeah.
And the eigenvalues are small.
I don't remember. I don't remember.
I thought you said they were having close to the real.
Yeah, they...
It's barely unstable, right? I mean, but what sets the scale for the eigenvalues?
That I don't remember. I don't remember. So, yeah, so that there's all these questions. Is that clear? Did I confuse everybody? All right, so why did I even bother doing all this? So it started with Carlo and I. What we did is this is a simulation of integrate and fire. Okay, this is starting at zero. This is the raster, so this is just the firing times. And what we wanted to just show was that that the bump, if you put in the correct gain function, the mean field thing describes the bump of just even 100 neurons. Okay, so here's integrate and fire, mean field calculation, which is only valid really in the infinite limit. And you get this straight line is the solution of this equation, and then the dots are different runs with different synaptic timescales, right? So synapse is a parameter that doesn't exist in the mean field thing, changes the solution slightly, but
so
it doesn't change that much.
So
I changed notation. This A is now just an activity. It's not a parameter anymore. It just means the firing rate. F of and big F is now the gain.
So how do you calculate F?
F of u is just the integrate and fire gain function. So we just simply took one single integrate and fire, and you get the one over log.
So that's the single neuron gain function.
It's a single neuron gain function. So what we were trying to show is that you calculate the single neuron gain function, use it in this thing, you get the shape of the bump, even for 100 neurons. So that's pretty good.
Do you include the self interaction?
The which one?
I zero or one?
Oh, do I include self interaction?
Yeah.
I can't remember. I think we do.
Sorry, what is W here? The same W?
If you don't, it changes?
No, it's sensitive. Yeah.
Okay, so that's something we should. I'll talk to you later. Okay, so that's what this.
So you don't have a problem with these integrated fire guys trying to synchronize?
Aha, that's. Yes, we do.
So wait, Carson.
Yes, we do.
I think game function should be pretty bad.
Yeah. No.
Has it, so the little portion down here where it just moves up from. The noise,
there's no noise in this game function.
There's no noise in the game function, but integrate and fire shouldn't have effectively smoothed out
that. Integrate and fire, the gain function looks like 1 over the log of u minus some threshold kind of thing. Right? That's so it looks like this.
So the neuron fire,
because it's synaptic noise. That's the reason.
What's that? There's no noise.
Right?
There's no noise. We could put noise, then it smooths out the gain function. This is the same Mexican hat, same kind of Mexican hat, except this is now the Mexican, not the witch's hat. So difference of Gauss.
The integration is valid for neurons which are firing periodically. Which equation? This gain.
Exactly, you're correct, and it's not firing exactly periodically.
Not firing exactly.
It's close to periodic, but not exactly periodic. And that's because of fluctuations. Right, there's finite size fluctuations. Our whole point is that the finite size fluctuations average.
They're almost periodic. That's why it works.
They're almost periodic, so that's why it works.
What is the interaction between the integrate and fire cells? Are they pulse coupled or what?
They're synapses. They're just each time you fire, you send a little synaptic blip.
A delta function or a time course?
It has a time course.
And is that what keeps them from synchronizing? The shape of this?
The fact is that you need the excitation to be relatively slow so they don't synchronize.
Okay.
So this now, is two populations or one?
This is one population. So this is Mexican hat. And we can do it in two populations.
Just one.
Yeah, so it's this fake kind of synapse, right?
Yeah,
it just turns into inhibition.
The time course is unique.
The time is the same for everybody, so the excitation inhibition is the same.
So does the synaptic time scale come into
yes,
the
variation
of the mean field?
No,
it doesn't. It gets averaged out.
Because it's
averaged.
So slow? Or just gets averaged out, assuming they're asynchronous?
So you can do mean field in two ways. You assume asynchrony. If you assume it's completely uncorrelated, then
right.
The input to any neuron is constant, and then you just then the mean field is just the same as everyone's done it for the last 20 years. So here's where speed kills. Okay. So John, here's the synapse. I didn't write it down, but here's our synapse. So the synaptic current. Okay, and you can make it smoother, but the critical thing is it decays with some time beta. And then we normalize it, so when we I always forget where the normalization goes, but when we increase beta, we also increase the amplitude, so the total integral is the same, right? So it's a fair game. The mean field limit, they should be the same. So now we do, simultaneously with running the thing, we just adiabatically speed up the synapse just to see what happens. And so the thing hangs around, and it starts to wander. These are the finite time fluctuations getting bigger, so this is like effective of noise. And then there's like this meandering transition, okay? The thing gets depinned, and it starts to random walk. Meandering, I don't know what they call it. Wandering transition. It just starts to depin. Meander is like a river, you know, when the river, before it gets to the ocean, it meanders. So it does this meandering. This is periodic boundary conditions, but if it wasn't, if it was a big domain, it would just random walk. And then there's a traveling wave thing. And you can see that the speed of the wave is actually increasing as theta increases, right? So the speed is proportional to beta somehow. And then eventually, the speed is infinite. They all fire together and it dies. So they synchronize and they die.
So does the transition beta depend on n time events?
Good. We did not investigate this carefully enough. So I don't know.
So how does beta, where they start to synchronize, compare with, say, membrane time constant?
I can't remember. But it's when the synapse is faster than the period is when they start to synchronize. So I don't remember how that's related to the membrane time constant. But it was period to beta, which was the critical transition, right? What is it, Carl? Like a few times faster than the period, it starts to synchronize.
There's
not
stable traveling.
No, there's no.
There might be a stable traveling wave. We never actually.
If we just stop changing beta.
If we just stop changing beta, there might be one. We never did that experiment, which we should. Because, well, David Gollum now has been pushing me to say, what's the difference between a bump and a wave, right? Because he says, I get waves, you get bumps. You know, why? And maybe it's because if I chose this beta, I would get a wave. So that's one thing that I'm trying to figure out now. So if you put a little bit of disorder in the connections or in the homogeneity of the neurons, then you can pin the bump. I don't have a picture of it, but what it does is it finds some local minimum and then stays there. So the last slide is, because synchrony can kill these things, then so you can turn it on and off using excitation. Okay, so here, time's going this way.
This one didn't synchronize.
What's that?
For fast enough synapses, you should start getting synchrony.
They'll synchronize, and then because they all fire together.
No,
eventually it'll go to synchrony. It just goes faster and faster. Then they all fire, and it dies.
And then it will stop.
So then the whole network kind of fires at once.
At the end, all this will stop.
What's that?
At the end, it'll die.
Yeah, at the end, it'll die. We didn't show it. Like at around 150 or something, it just dies. Because they all fire together, and that's it.
But and if you keep changing
beta, but if you so if we fixed it here, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. I do know that if I start with too fast a beta, it can never get. It starts asynchronous. It's happy, and then it starts to synchronize in its day. Yeah. Well, I mean, adiabatic is just we didn't really do it adiabatically. So you're right. There's a lot of things. There's a whole bunch of grad students could just investigate this.
They're doing their PhD in adiabatic.
What?
Adiabatic PhD.
Yeah, an adiabatic PhD. Some of them are doing adiabatic PhDs. Progress is adiabatic. Okay, so this is now we have noise, okay, Peter? So we actually put in some sporadic synaptic input, so we're trying to make it look like...
So what is the upper one?
Okay, so the upper one is just the firing times.
Yeah, but what is what's going on? You turn on and off something?
Okay, so here, before time 10, nothing's going on, okay? So you have sporadic input and sporadic firing. And then at time t, we give a big pulse of excitation. So say we want to remember, you know, this location here and the monkeys.
So sporadic firing is just external input that's...
Yeah, it's just sporadic external input. The neurons themselves have no noise source. It's just they're getting sporadic synaptic input. Then we give a big juice of charge. They go firing fast here, and then we let go. And now this thing persists. It wanders a little bit. And then here, You can't see it, I don't know why, but here we give it, then we give another synchronizing pulse here. Okay, it didn't show up in this figure. But what we did is we just hit it hard. Everybody in the network between here and here got one pulse. They all fired together. There was an echo, and then it died. What's that?
The bump is not required for this.
The bump is not required. The only reason we want a bump is that... He'll still do this. He'll still do this.
Wait, so I don't see what talking about being fired.
Okay, so here everybody fired together, and then they fired...
Everybody?
Yeah, that's everybody. Well, I mean everybody from here to here. Everybody in the bump. From 20 to 80, they all fired.
Oh, that's the width of the...
That's bump. The width of the kick. So we induced everybody between 20 and 80 to fire, and then there was a little echo. They managed to fire again, and then they...
And what is the mechanism?
So what we think is that we just line everybody up, and then the synapse might have enough to fire it again, but then eventually, because there's not enough input, they don't fire. Just sub-threshold is what we
think. They go back to the rest state.
Then they go back to this sporadic rest state. So that's kind of, you know, here's the monkey, and then needs to remember something, and then the saccade, it gets a little excitation, and our whole thing was that, you know, you could turn it on and off with excitation,
so
which we thought was like a
toggle. How generally this phenomenon that you can turn off a system state by a brief excitation? This is a particular model.
Yeah, so we did it also in a two-layer model with Hodgkin-Huxley neurons. So we tried to use cortically faithful types of neurons, and we can do the same thing. The critical thing is that you need to have reasonably fast synapses, so that you need synapses so the synaptic time scale is shorter than the time scale of the period, and then you also need it to be relatively balanced.
But it has to be relatively slow, otherwise it's synchronous.
So one of the things that keeps them from synchronizing is that there is, because of the effect of heterogeneity, helps to keep them desynchronous. The fact that when it's a bump, they're all firing at different rates. So the input that each neuron is getting is different. So there's an effective self-generated heterogeneity because it's a mound.
But it can't be too fast. I mean,
it can't be too fast, because then otherwise they synchronize. And it can't be too slow, because then they just persist. Well, I mean, but then you can turn it off, because Nicola and Xiaojing showed that what you do is you hit the excitation hard, which hits the inhibition hard, which then turns it off. So you could... Well, you could actually hit the excitation, which then locally hits the inhibition and turns it off that way.
Wait. If you hit the excitation somewhere, you hit the inhibition, then you have to
find it,
right?
Yeah, but you can do it this way, too. You could have it hit the excitation really hard, which then hits the inhibition hard, which then comes back and hits the excitation hard. But this way is faster, because you just hit it once. And
if you do it in a rate model, this is in the simulation we did it prior, right?
Yeah.
If you do it in the original rate model?
You can't turn it off with excitation.
You tried?
We tried it. Well, there's no synchronizing. You can do it in a two-layer rate model.
Right. But in the one layer, if you just give it a big shot, it will not turn.
You could turn it. You could get everybody to fire. You could go to the constant state.
So you could turn off the bump. Yeah.
You can make the bump into everybody on.
Now here, is there a solution here where everybody fires? Mm-hmm. A stable solution?
When everybody fires together?
Is this also a stable solution here?
The synchronous solution, you mean? It's not.
Uniform.
Oh, in uniform.
No, because then they will synchronize.
Well, uniform asynchrony is this problem.
That doesn't say synchrony. Because they all have the same rate.
I think it is, but I don't know. I didn't check.
Beyond a certain value of alpha, right?
I don't know, to tell you the truth.
Well, you told that before.
Oh, I know that in principle there was, but I think Haim wants to know in this simulation whether or not.
You do have also asynchronous homogeneous.
Yeah, that exists.
Exists.
That does. I don't know in this simulation whether it exists, because we didn't look.
There is. No, I'm saying in this particular. Yeah.
In this particular simulation, does it exist? I don't know. We didn't find it, but.
Because the question is, when you give it excitation,
it could get into that state.
Yeah, that state.
And we never get at that state. But we never, you know.
But
we never tried. So what you need to do is you need to excite everybody kind of like this. And see whether or not it stays, and we never tried it.
But I think you can say that it's incompatible. Either you have the bump solution or you have the...
No, you could have the bump and the all-on.
In the right model, you can have both.
But that's something, this is sort of superthreshold, because you have noise, so neurons fired.
No, it's subthreshold because there's these two states, so this is still subthreshold. Yeah. It's bistable with the... This is off. This is just taking the gain function and saying that the gain function, instead of the sharp thing, it's got a little
thing.
So you can still have two bistable states, right? Because you can still have low firing and then high firing. And then, you know.
What would the uniform solution be in this?
The uniform would then just be this high firing state. So it would be the whole network like this, but asynchronous, and everybody is. It's the ones that, you know, Carl, David, they look at.
So the heterogeneity is enough to have some guys spontaneously act in the low state?
What did you say that again? Oh, well, you mean this
heterogeneity?
This
state.
Which this. Oh, the red state.
Some of the cells are just spontaneously acting. Is this with noise?
Yeah, this is noise. This is sporadic synaptic input, which then occasionally causes sporadic firing.
Pastor, are you done with your talk?
Yeah, I'm done.
One question. What is the firing rate inside the bump?
What's the firing rate inside the bump? This one, well, I guess you could count them. I guess here's 10, so it's pretty fast. But then these are kind of made up units. It's integrating fire. So
it's going fine.
Yeah, and we didn't calibrate it.
Yeah, but, what do you mean?
I mean, we don't know what these units mean, right? They're just time units. So the time constant is one. So one is one.
So
I mean.
but
the question you want to ask is, can you get reasonable physiological firing rates, right? And so we did do a calibrated model with Hodgkin-Huxley neurons, two layers, and we can get the slowest.
The lowest one.
So, the lowest one is zero, but the fastest guy in the bump that we were able to achieve was on the order of 40 to 50 hertz.
That's in the paper.
That's in one of the papers.
Okay.
That's in Boris's paper.
But you need two layers for that. Or you did it with two layers.
We did it with two layers just to make it more cortical.
You mean the cartesian division?
Yeah. So we had E cell. So that one, the low, and that's because Carlo Lang, my postdoc, has just got the magic touch, and he was able to titrate it down to a low firing rate. Usually when we started out, it's like 110 hertz, right? That's easy. And then he's just, you know, he can balance this. He juggles five balls. He gets it down to 40, 50 hertz. So what I'm going to have my grad student do next is to look at the two-layer, do the same thing we did here with the two-layer thing. So now a single bump is 10 equations.
What
is the
difference between this two-layer and your previous one?
So the two-layer one would just be, you have to separate the E and I populations out so they each have their own coupling.
But you said that now you're going to do two-layer. Oh, in the rate model.
The rate model.
Oh, in the rate model.
Rate model. We're going to go back and investigate stationary solutions in the rate model to answer your question finally. How do you get it? Okay. So that's the course. Thanks.